This is the lecture on World War II. I'd like to begin with an apology. Someone wrote in the discussion forum that on my lecture last week when I had the slides, some of the material at the bottom of the various slides was cut off. I'm afraid I have a tendency to cram a lot of stuff into one slide, so I'm sorry about that. I'm going to resend that lecture with more slides, which should eliminate the problem. In this lecture, I hope I try to make it so you'll be able to read all the slides. So one area point about World War II, I think, is really essential if we're going to understand the war. Some wars we can consider just by themselves. Say, when I spoke about the Spanish-American War in the second lecture, we didn't really need to have the background of the war between the states or civil war. If, say, you missed the first lecture, you wouldn't have missed anything if you just heard the lecture on the Spanish-American War. You wouldn't have been missing anything that you needed to understand the Spanish-American War. And then, certainly, in the last week on World War I origins, the Spanish-American War had perhaps some relevance to World War I. We could point to things like, say, that Britain became closer to the United States after the Spanish-American War had begun. Remember, the British were first opposed to the U.S. They were more sympathetic to Spain, but then they became more favorable under Joseph Chamberlain, the colonial secretary, particularly, who was pro-American. So maybe this has some causal bearing on origins of America's policy in World War I, but still, we could really consider the World War I independently of the Spanish-American War. Again, we don't need the Spanish-American War to understand America's participation in World War I. But World War II is a different matter altogether. We can't understand World War II at all unless we keep World War I in mind, because much of World War II, especially on the German side, was an effort to reverse the verdict of World War I, which Germany lost. Now, when the war ended, remember the armistice was November 11, 1918, the 11th hour of the 11th month, November 11, 1918, the Germans had asked for an armistice. It was based on Woodrow Wilson's 14 points. I'm sure most of you have heard of the 14 points. This was a speech that Wilson had given to Congress in January 1918. So what Wilson was basically saying in this speech, he didn't favor a punitive peace. He wasn't saying, well, when we win, we're going to go in and smash Germany, get rid of Austria, we'll just completely demolish them. He was saying we're going to have a new, more just international order. He said, in fact, the first point is open covenants of peace openly arrived at. I said that I remember in when I was very young, which was a long time ago, there was a quiz show called, like, the $64,000 question. And one of the questions on the show, people would be able to win very large prizes. They answered various questions. And one of them was to name all Wilson's 14 points. And the person did it, but then it later turned out the whole quiz show had been rigged, and I think the guy knew the answers in advance. So the 14 points, though, to say Wilson wasn't didn't favor punitive peace. And, among the points were the restoration of Belgium. Remember, the Germans had gone in and violated Belgian neutrality at the beginning of the war. So one of the points was restoration of Belgium, and then the another point called for the self-determination for the subject nationality, the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Remember, there are all sorts of nationalities, Serbs, Czechs, various others in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and some of them wanted to have their own independent state. So this was one of the points, was that they would be each nationality would be able to determine the sort of rule over itself. And it also, the 14 points called for an independent Poland. Remember, Poland was, been since the third partition of Poland, remember the three partitions of Poland, 1772, 1793, 1795, during the third partition of Poland, Poland had been under just part of the Tsarist Empire, but the Tsarist Russia had been overthrown, so the 14 points were calling for an independent Poland. So this agreement, the armistice agreement, based on the 14 points, which was not, didn't say, remember that said the 14 points didn't say we're going to really smash the Germans. So when the Germans surrendered, or agreed to an armistice, they agreed on the 14 points, with the exception of point two, which was the freedom of the seas. Now, the British were against that because the British wanted to be in control of the seas. They had the most powerful navy in the world, so they didn't like freedom of the seas, as most people interpret it. But the Germans did, the 14 points did not, like I said this before, but it bears repeating, they did not call for harsh measures against Germany. And the Germans stressed, when they signed the armistice, they were certainly losing. Remember, Austria had dropped out of the war, and the German army had been pushed back by the Allies, by the French, British, and Americans, but they hadn't been forced back to German soil. So all the war had been outside of Germany. The Germans had been pushing out, and the whole war was trying to get them out of the territory that they'd gone into. So the Germans said, well, you know, we're getting this armistice, you know, maybe you could come in and try to take us over, but you might not be able to, you might not be able to do that if we hadn't signed an armistice. So the Germans thought, well, they're not really surrendering in the full sense. They lost, but they hadn't really been defeated in the sense that their country had been invaded. So it turned out in the Treaty of Peace that was signed by Germany and the Allies, it was much more severe than the Germans expected based on this armistice agreement. I mean, naturally, the Germans didn't expect that they'd come out really well in the peace treaty, because after all, they were the losers. They didn't expect that they'd be dealt with as harshly as they were in the Versailles Treaty. At one point, unlike the many peace conferences, say the Congress of Vienna in 1814, in 1815, the Germans weren't part of the negotiation for this Treaty of Versailles. They were simply presented with the treaty when it was done, said you better sign this or else. Now, what were some of these measures? Well, one which didn't have really any material consequences, it was very hard on the German sense of national pride, was they had to sign the treaty, even though one article of the treaty, the famous Article 231, blamed Germany for the war. So Germany had to sign a treaty that said, you did it, you're responsible for this terrible war. and naturally they're not very happy about doing that. So let's have a look at the same Article 231, that the allied and associated government. Now, can anybody tell me why does it say associated government? Does anybody know that? Well, because the United States was technically not an ally of Britain and France. They just were associated. They said they were an associated government. So that really meant the United States. But the allied associated governments affirm in Germany accepts the responsibility of Germany and her allies for causing all the loss and damage to which the allied and associated governments and their nationals have been subjected as a consequence of the war imposed upon them by the aggression of Germany and her allies. So here we have really unusual, we have a history really by political statement. It would seem like normally we think who's responsible for a war would be something to be settled by historical investigation, but here we have a treaty that's saying this is what the war responsibility is. You have to take it. And in fact, one other article of the treaty was never actually enforced, called for the surrender of the former German Kaiser Wilhelm II, when he abdicated both his emperor, Kaiser, and also King of Prussia. But it called for his trial as a war criminal. So this is another thing that the Germans resented. Now, it's interesting, one of the authors of this Article 231, just sort of in passing, I thought it's interesting, was John Foster Dulles, who some of you, I'm sure most of you or all of you are too young to remember. He was the Secretary of State under President Eisenhower. He was one of the two authors of this article. So in this treaty, it was much more than this blow to national pride where they had to admit the responsibility to the war. Germany lost part of East Prussia to Poland. And the German port city of Danzig, which was an extremely important German port, it was all German city, it was put under a League of Nations High Commissioner. It was taken away from Germany. It was really subject to Polish control, and the Poles discriminated against Danzig to promote their competing port of Gdynia. This was one of the big things that the Germans didn't like, and we'll see later in the lecture, this is the city of Danzig played a crucial role in bringing on the crisis in September 1939. Also, Germany lost all her colonies. Germany had colonies in Africa and various other places, but they had to give them all up. Then, in probably the most famous provision of the treaty, Germany had to pay reparations for all the damage her aggression has caused. So this Article 231 wasn't just saying, well, we think you did it, and you have to admit this, so since we're the victors, we can make you do this. This is to have a basis. It wasn't just this historical word. This is to give the whole basis for saying, since you caused this aggression and you admitted this yourself because you signed the treaty, you have to pay for everything. And this includes the cost of war pensions that they, in the Allied countries, soldier veterans have been injured and they receive pensions from the government just like people today that in the war get veterans benefit. So this was saying that Germany has to pay for all that. Now, I didn't put this in the slide, of course, this inaugurated a famous controversy with the great British economist Lord Keynes wrote a book called The Economic Consequences of Peace, where he said Germany can't pay this, and it turned out they didn't pay shooting recreation, they paid some, but he said, came that they just can't, won't be able to pay that much. That's a controversial argument. I should say Mises didn't accept that. He thought they could have paid it. But Rothbard agrees with Keynes on this point. I think the dominant opinion is that Keynes was right about it. But so this is one thing that really hit them in the pocketbook. They have to pay reparations. Now, another treaty provision that affected Germans adversely, this was part of the Treaty of Saint-Germain. And see, there were various treaties that were signed in the suburbs of Paris. Versailles was a suburb of Paris. The Treaty of Saint-Germain was a treaty signed with Austria. And all these treaties collectively, the Treaty of Versailles, Treaty of Saint-Germain, Treaty of Trianon. Trianon is another, you know, palace around near Paris. These are all called collectively the Treaty of Paris. The Treaty of Saint-Germain completely broke up the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The 14 points, it says about self-determination for subject nationality of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It didn't say we're just going to get rid of the Austro-Hungarian Empire altogether, but that was what they did in the treaty. And among these, the new nations that was established was Czechoslovakia. Remember, that was established, the Pittsburgh Agreement in 1918. There was a large German minority in the new state of Czechoslovakia. So even though the 14 points were saying self-determination, this didn't apply to the German minority in this new state of Czechoslovakia. And we'll see again later in the lecture how this led to a lot of trouble later on. Now, why have I been talking so much about the Treaty of Versailles? I mean, after all, this is a lecture on World War II, not the aftermath of World War I. And the reason I talk about the Versailles Treaty so much is that the dominant theme of European diplomatic history, the 1930s, is Germany's efforts to revise the treaty. The Germans, this, not just the Hitler and the Nazis, but practically all the Germans, really resented this Versailles Treaty. They said this is, we agreed to an armistice on the basis of the 14 points, and look what happened. We have this dictated peace with Versailles, so we don't want this. We're going to try to get these provisions that are against our interests. We're going to try to get rid of them. So, supposing that's true, but why would this involve the U.S.? How did, supposing the Germans were trying to get the Versailles Treaty changed, how would this involve the U.S.? Well, one thing we have to grasp in U.S. policy in the 1920s, America largely retreated from the interventionist policies of World War I. Remember, Wilson, in his speech to Congress in April 1917, said, the world must be made safe for democracy. And he, in the Treaty of Versailles, it has provision for a League of Nations, so he wanted America to play an active role in world politics, continuing the theme what he had wanted in World War I. So he said, we're going to be really reconstructing the world to make the world safe for democracy. But this wasn't what the American people favored in the 1920s. The U.S. in the 1920s, we had the presidency of Warren Harding, Calvin Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover in the 1920s, three Republican presidents. The U.S. refused to join the League of Nations or the World Court. The U.S. didn't want to get involved. Now, the League of Nations was based on a principle called collective security. And what the idea was saying, well, supposing a nation commits aggression, then all the other nations will take action against it. It would be, say, if you were, say, some leader said, well, I want to take over certain territory, I'm going to start a war, then the idea was all the other powers would just form an armed league against you. So the theory was, if people knew that, then there wouldn't be any aggression, because they would say, well, I can't lead my country into war, because then all these other countries are going to come out against me. So what's wrong with this idea? What is the big problem with it? It sounds like maybe it would work, wouldn't it? Something like, if you think, well, I'm going to commit aggression, then if I know I'm going to be faced with overwhelming force against me, wouldn't this be a good deterrent? Well, the big problem with it is that this makes sure every international dispute becomes a world war. I mean, suppose we have some kind of local border skirmish. So on this principle, then all the other nations would have to come in and start a war against whatever nation was deemed to be the aggressor. And then another problem, I didn't put this in the slides, but another problem is aggression isn't a really clear concept. We can usually establish which side of fate is taken the first blow, or which side is fired first, but why, if you say that automatically aggressor, then you're saying something, the status quo must be preserved at all costs. Why can't an aggrieved power say, look, the people who are holding our territory, the territory that's wrongly taken from us, are really aggressing against us, so even if we take up arms first, we're not the real aggressors. So sort of this view is kind of assuming that there's some kind of clear notion of aggression, and this is a big problem with it. Now, the great American historian Charles Beard called this policy of collective security perpetual war for perpetual peace. And one thing he points out in his book, a very good book called President Roosevelt and the Coming of the War, 1941, which was published by Yale University Press in 1948. He says this policy ensures that every dispute becomes a world war. So he said, this is not a good idea. We have the notion that any dispute anywhere really involves our own security. And we can see this assumption really in foreign policy, American foreign policy today. We have the view, well, what happens, say, in Iraq or Iran is not just, we have to be interested in this because it's going to affect us. Maybe if Iran gets a nuclear bomb, this would have not only some effect on the balance of power in the Middle East, but it has some direct effect on us. So we have this whole assumption that the whole world is kind of intertwined, so we have to be interested in everything. Beard questioned this, and most people in the United States rejected this view of collective security. Now, although the U.S. followed this largely non-interventionist policy in the 20s. It said, well, we don't want to get involved in collective security. One rather dangerous step was taken with the Kellogg-Briand Pact of 1928. Frank Kellogg was the American Secretary of State, and Briand is Aristide Briand, who was the French foreign minister. So what this pact was a treaty to outlaw aggressive war. So all the states who signed this renounced aggressive war as an instrument of policy. Now, in fact, it really didn't commit them to all that much because it allowed exceptions for self-defense. It didn't really define self-defense, so a nation could really say, well, even if we're just defending ourselves, we're not aggressive. So the treaty really didn't commit them to much. But what's dangerous about this pact was it makes political dispute matters of law. So supposing, say, it actually happened, as we'll see later, there's a dispute between Germany and Poland on whether the city of Danzig should return to Germany. So instead of thinking of this as a dispute, certain people have certain, Germans have certain interests, the Poles have other interests. Here it makes it a legal question, even though there isn't clear international law about such things. These are political disputes. And if a nation is judged to be in violation of the pact, it could then be subject to collective security. So the Kellogg-Briand pact essentially sounds like it's sort of helping to prevent war. It's really leading to more war because it's getting collective security in by the back door. And in the 1930s, this mentality, the mentality behind the Kellogg-Briand pact, led to the idea of outlawing nations, of nations that were violating law by aggressing against others. And we'll see where this comes in later on the lecture, famous speech by Franklin Roosevelt. So, as I mentioned before, Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover, the three Republican presidents in the 1920s, largely followed isolationist foreign policy. They said, we don't want to get involved in collective security. We want to stay out of war. However, by misspelled state, how stupid it is, Hoover's Secretary of State, not Sadie, is probably sated with things. Henry Stimson was more warlike. He'd been Secretary of War under Taft, William Howard Taft. He would again be Secretary of War under FDR. He'd also in the 1920s been Governor General of Philippines. So he was quite anti-Japanese. And when Japan took over Manchuria in 1931, Stimson wanted action against Japan. The conditions in China were very chaotic. There wasn't a clear central authority. There were various warlords who were competing for parts of China. And Japan thought this would be a good chance for them to come in and to take over part of China. And they called it Manchu, quote, and they established their own protectorate there. So Stimson wanted action against Japan. The Stimson Doctrine, January 1932, refused recognition to changes due to force. So remember, normally countries have diplomatic recognition of each other. We have ambassadors or ministers in all the different countries. It doesn't imply that we politically approve of the government. It's just the usual custom of international law is if the government is able to control a certain territory, then the other powers will give it recognition. But Stimson said, we're not going to recognize changes due to force. So this is something that it sounds good, I suppose. Well, why should we recognize them due to force? But it could lead to conflict. If you say, well, we're not going to recognize this because you use force, and then the next step is we're going to use force ourselves to make you disgorge your conquest. So this, again, was a break with isolation and non-involvement, say you're using force, so possibly we're going to do something to you. Now, remember last week when we talked about the origins of the war in Europe, I mentioned the revisionist historians such as Sidney Bradshaw, Fay was one, Harry Ulmer Barnes is another one. And these revisionist historians had a very wide popular following. Probably today there aren't that many people in the public who read books about World War I origins, but in those days, 1920s, it was a big public issue. People, Harry Ulmer Barnes in particular, was a leading public intellectual. He had newspaper articles in New York Times, all sorts of other newspapers. So everybody was talking about World War I origins. But many people, probably the majority of people in America, thought that American participation in World War I had been a big mistake, and the view that became prominent in the 1920s and continued in the 30s was that we'd been drawn into disputes that really didn't concern us. The view was, well, whether Germany or France should be the dominant power in Western Europe is an interesting question, but why should we get involved in the war about this? Or why do we care if the Germans are challenging British naval supremacy? What is that to us? Why should we get involved? So, when, as you say, this view of World War I, in part due to the revisionist historians, although not entirely, but just people suffered very heavy losses in the war, and then there were people who asked, well, what's this worth it? What did we gain by it? They didn't think we gained anything. So when FDR became president in 1933, I remember just, and I like these trivia questions, what month did FDR become president in 1933? Can anybody tell me? March. Yes, March. That he was the last president who was inaugurated in March, not January. We think it that was the way the Constitution originally established it, and the reason it's in the Constitution that way is people say, "Oh well, because they would think it's harder to get to Washington D.C. in the winter." That wasn't the real reason. The reason is March in the 18th century was considered the first month of the year, so that's why it's in March. Now that isn't really relevant to World War II origins, I just like a lot of digressions. So when FDR became president, he first continued the isolation policy of his predecessors. He didn't call for a revival of Wilson's policies. So we think, and it will be explained later, Roosevelt was a very interventionist president. He really liked to get us into the World War II, as we'll see. But we shouldn't make the mistake of thinking this was true from the beginning of his presidency. He did not call for a revival of Wilson's policies. And Charles Beard, who was the historian I mentioned before, was stresses in a book he called American Foreign Policy in the Making, 1932-1940. He was stressing that Franklin Roosevelt started off as a very isolationist president. Something about shifting focus. Well, I'm not good on camera. So, all right, so why had America gotten involved in World War I? Well, you remember from the last lecture, one of the key issues was that there were passengers, American citizens, who were on Allied merchant ships, and when the German submarine blew up these merchant ships, Americans lost their lives in the signal of Lusitania, Sussex, so this aroused a great deal of popular resentment. This is one of the key factors that is into the war. So in the reaction against American entry into World War I, people are saying, well, this is a mistake. We're saying, well, we want to make sure this doesn't happen again. So how can we do that? Well, and the way they would do that would be we'd have legislation that says to Americans, if you get on, if there's a war and you get on ships from one of the fighting powers and the other side attacks you, America isn't going to do anything about this. You're doing this at your own risk. So they're trying to ensure in advance that we don't have any incidents where people say, well, Americans have lost their lives on these ships that are being attacked, so therefore we have to get into the war. Neutrality legislation was saying, if you do this, you're going to do this at your own risk. An additional factor was that in the 1930s, people had very much the view that one thing that had gotten us into the war was a big arms race. And there was arms manufacturers that was claimed that they propagandized for war and just tried to get the war, help get the war started just so they could sell more arms. There was a famous book in the 1930s called Merchants of Death. I think you can get that in the Mises website. So this is a very popular view that arms trafficking, selling arms, was very dangerous. There was a committee headed by Senator Gerald Nye of North Dakota, and he held hearings stressing the dangers of arms trafficking. So the Neutrality Act of 1935, 36, 37, 39, forbade shipments of arms to belligerents. And so I said, well, since we want to avoid this arms trafficking, if there's a war, you won't be able to ship arms to belligerents. And as I said before, neutrality legislation said that American travelers on armed ships did so at their own risk. And some of these neutrality acts are different provisions in a different act, said, you can't travel on these ships at all. Now, the 1937-39 Act included, modified this ban on arms shipments. It included cash and carry provision, where it would permit sale of arms if people paid for them right away. But you couldn't have, remember in World War I, there had been, we shipped arms just on the basis of loans, but under the Neutrality Act, with cash and carry, you couldn't do that anymore. The belligerents would only be able to buy arms if they paid for them. Now, as I said before, one of the main points of the Nazi program was to end the parts of the Treaty of Versailles that were bad for Germany. In fact, one thing that Hitler said, not only did he want to end the Treaty of Versailles, but he thought that the Germans should not have signed the treaty at all. He thought German national honor would better serve had they refused, the German government refused to sign, even if that led to a military occupation of Germany. He said, these no good people in the Weimar Republic really betrayed German national honor by this signing the treaty. So Hitler soon made it evident that when he said he wanted to get rid of the Treaty of Versailles, he wasn't kidding. And he came to power in 1933, so he very soon left the League of Nations. Germany had been readmitted to the League of Nations in the 1920s, or admitted to the League of Nations in the 1920s. He reintroduced conscription that hadn't been allowed in the Treaty of Versailles, except we're going to have to draft people in the army. In 1936, he remilitarized the Rhineland. Under the treaty, the Rhineland was supposed to not have any German soldiers in it. It was supposed to ensure that the Germans wouldn't attack, because if the Rhineland wouldn't attack France, because if the Rhineland didn't have any German soldiers, then if Germany declared war, France would simply go into the Rhineland and the war would be guaranteed to be fought in Germany. So this would really prevent Germany from doing anything in the West. They couldn't really do anything in the East either, because again, France, if they say they decided they wanted to invade Russia, and France could simply come into the Rhineland and get them in the rear. So remilitarizing the Rhineland is very important. Now, so we now have to shift to a different country. We're talking about Germany so far now. We now want to go to Italy. In October 1934, there was a fight between Ethiopian troops and Somalis, and the Somalis were under Italian leadership. It appears, although people still dispute what happened, the Ethiopian troops decided to attack the Italians. This is called the Walwal incident, after the place where it incident happened. So the Italians used this incident as an excuse to invade Ethiopia near the end of 1935. The Italians said, well, we don't, you know, the British and French have these big empires, we want to have an empire too, so we want to make Ethiopia an Italian colony. Remember, the Italians were trying to avenge a famous loss in 1898, the Battle of Ottawa, where the Ethiopians had defeated the Italian army, so Italians invaded. Now, remember, we talked about collective security. The League of Nations imposed sanctions on Italy when they did this after the failure of the Horla-Val Pact. Now, the Horla-Val Pact was an agreement between the British Foreign Secretary, Sir Samuel Hoare, and Pierre Laval, who was the French foreign minister. He became notorious under the World War II as kind of collaborator with the Germans, but he was very prominent in the 1930s. He was a protege of Aristide Briand. Remember, I mentioned Briand in the Kellogg-Briand Pact. So what the Horla-Val Pact did was that we're going to preserve a little bit of Ethiopia's independence, and we're going to let Mussolini have most of the territory in Ethiopia, but he needs not to invade anymore. So after this pact was signed, there's a big reaction against it, and then the League of Nations had sanctions against Italy. Now, these sanctions drove Italy into closer relations with Germany. The Italians said, well, we don't want to be associated with the British, especially we're backing the League of Nations, so we don't like this because they're trying to sanction us. And so this drove them into close relations with Germany, even though the League abandoned sanctions after the fall of the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, to Italians. Now, another thing, there are all sorts of things that are happening in Europe in the 1930s, was that a war broke out in Spain in 1936, the Spanish Civil War, when nationalist officers revolted against the leftist Spanish government. And in this war, Germany and Italy supported the nationalists, in Soviet Russia supported the Spanish Republic. So see, what we've got all sorts of events happening in Europe in the early to mid-30s. Germany is remilitarized the Rhineland. They're giving indications they're going to try to reverse the Treaty of Versailles. The Italians have invaded Ethiopia. There's a civil war going on in Spain in which Italy and Germany are aiding the nationalists, and Soviet Russia is aiding the Republic. And also, what I mentioned before, the Japanese are continuing to make incursions in China. So Japan became drew closer to Germany and Italy. And the three nations signed what's called the Anti-Comintern Pact. Can anyone tell me what is the Comintern Does anybody know that? Yes, as he said, communist. Yeah, it was an organization of all the world's communist parties. So the view that it was that the Germans and Townsend would say the communist parties are trying to overthrow all the governments of the world and establish communist revolutions, so we're going to have a pact against them. It's called the Anti-Communism Pact. Now, around this time, Franklin Roosevelt, remember, he previously gone along with the, basically gone along with the isolationist policy of the 1920s, he decided that these nations, Germany, Italy, and Japan, were a threat to world peace, and he wanted to take action against them. And he signaled the new policy in a speech on October 5th, 1937, that's usually called the Quarantining the Aggressor speech. And here he said in this speech, it was, I'm giving a quotation from him, he said, "The peace, the freedom, the security of 90% of the population of the world is being jeopardized by the remaining 10% who are threatening a breakdown of all international order and law." He goes on, "Surely the 90% who want to live in peace under law and in accordance with moral standards that have received almost universal acceptance through the centuries can and must find some way to make their will prevail." So what Roosevelt is saying is there are these nations, the 10%, Germany, Italy, and Japan, were the bad guys, and everybody else is all right. We've got to quarantine these aggressive, got to isolate them from everybody else. Just to say somebody has an illness, you know, contagious illness like tuberculosis, they can be quarantined. They're not allowed to go out in public because they might infect others. So Roosevelt's calling for quarantine the aggressor. And he, Soviet Russia was apparently included among the 90% peace-loving nations. They were didn't have any problem with them, just with the Germany, Italy, and Japan. Now, the question actually comes up, why did Roosevelt abandon the neutrality policy of the 1920s? Why are you saying, well, we've got to go after these aggressors? Well, one motive was that the New Deal, the economic policies that Roosevelt had put in to try to end the Depression of the 1930s, wasn't working very well. There was still a whole lot of unemployment. Roosevelt hadn't been able to get the economy going. So his general plan was he wanted a new source of spending to try to create an artificial boom. But if he wanted to do that, he'd have a big, another problem with why would Congress agree to appropriate money for government spending, just as we see now. President Obama proposed all sorts of plans for government spending, but he had a lot of trouble getting through Congress. And of course, Roosevelt had a Democratic Congress. The party was in his favor, but still would have a big problem getting a lot of spending through Congress. So one way he could solve this problem was to have a war scare with increased military spending, then he could be able to generate an artificial boom, and he might be able to get us. He could say, well, we got out of the Depression because of this spending. And also, the government would have an excuse to take over more of the economy. And in the reading I gave you by John T. Flynn, the great supporter or proponent of the old right in the 1930s and 40s, he was one who very much stressed this analysis that it was kind of a military Keynesian. So Keynes said, we've got to spend more money. And the idea was one thing they could spend money on is military buildup, so you need a war scare for that. Now, Hitler had gone on very much with his program to reverse the Versailles verdict. Remember I mentioned on the Treaty of St. Germain, Austria was forbidden from rejoining Germany, reuniting with Germany, even though the great majority of Austrians wanted to be part of Germany. They weren't allowed to do this, at least not without the permission of the Allied nation. So in March 1938, Hitler took over Austria. What happened was the Austrian chancellor, his name Kurt von Schuschnigg, suddenly announced a plebiscite that would have upset plans for setting Nazi inroads into Austria. But the Austrians, what the Nazis planned to do, they had various ministers, such as Seyss Inquart, who was a minister of the interior in the Austrian government. So they thought, well, they'd just come in and they'd gradually take over Austria. But the Austrian chancellor said, well, we're going to have this plebiscite. Do you want a free, democratic, independent Austria? So this was, Hitler took this as a personal affront, and he just came in and took over Austria. And exactly, Schuschnigg, do you know what happened to Schuschnigg? He was in a concentration camp, but he became, after the war, he became a professor in St. Louis, and I think he died in the 1970s, so he was still around quite a bit after the war. Then, after this happened, the Czechoslovakia was very upset. They said, well, you know, Hitler's taken over Austria, maybe we're next. So in May 1938, Czechoslovakia mobilized its army, and this really enraged Hitler. He said, well, I'm going to really get the Czechs for this. He didn't like the Czechs anyway, especially the president of Czechoslovakia, Edvard Beneš. So he said, we're going to take action again. So Hitler demanded that the Czechs give up the Sudetenland, which was a part, to put two loves here, of Czechoslovakia with a very large German population. And he said, if they don't do this, they don't give up Czechoslovakia, he's threatened to invade. So at the famous Munich conference, which was September 29th and 30th, 1938, Britain and France agreed to Hitler's demands. So Britain and France said, well, we'll agree to let you take over the Sudetenland, because this they thought would promote peace in Europe. If they did this, they said, well, maybe if Hitler gets what he wants to revise the Treaty of Versailles. And actually, they have a pretty good case that the Sudeten, people in the Sudetenland want to become part of Germany, so maybe we should agree to this. And then the Germans then took over the Sudetenland. The reason that this the effect why how Britain France could you say, well, how can they surrender Czech territory? They're not in control of Czechoslovakia. They would could just say to the Czechs, look, if you don't agree to this, we're not going to support you if Hitler invades. So that was the pressure on the Czechs. Roosevelt did not oppose the Munich Agreement. I think he sent a telegram to Chamberlain, a message saying something like, good man. So he was not then an opponent of the Munich Agreement. Now, after 1939, it turned out that this Munich settlement did not really resolve the issues between concerning Czechoslovakia. The Slovaks decided under Monsignor Jozef Tiso, T-I-S-O, decided to attack, to seek independence. They said, we don't want to be part of Czechoslovakia anymore. Remember, there were various other people, Poland had taken over part of Czechoslovakia also. And the Hungarians, I don't think, liked the Czechs very much. So a lot of people didn't like Czechoslovakia. So Hitler decided to back the Slovaks in their independence. The Czechs said they're going to invade Slovakia if they become independent. So Hitler said, well, I'm going to back the Slovaks. And he decided to take over what remained of the Czech state in March 1939, made the German protectorate. So this made the British very upset, because before the Germans said, well, we want to have all these German-speaking people come into Germany, and they seemed like, okay, they have a pretty good case, but now they were taking over an estate that didn't, the Czechs didn't want to be part of Germany. They didn't want to be a German protectorate, but Hitler's taking them over anyway. So the British Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, remember, he's the son of Joseph Chamberlain, one we mentioned in last week's lecture. He gave a speech saying that Hitler intended to conquer the world, which is a bit extreme. I mean, he certainly wanted to make changes in Eastern Europe, but doesn't sound like he wanted to conquer the world. And the British also guaranteed the Polish border, so the British sent to the Pole, you know, if Hitler makes demands on you, we're going to guarantee your borders if you resist Hitler, if you don't accept them. And Russian come up, well, why did the British abandon their appeasement possibility? They thought, maybe we can come to some sort of agreement with Germany as they had at the time of Munich. And here it appears that the British Foreign Secretary, Lord Halifax, played a more active role in British foreign policy after the Munich Conference. He favored a more aggressive policy toward Germany and Chamberlain did. And also, there's evidence that Franklin Roosevelt encouraged the British to follow more anti-German policy. I think there's something in the diaries of the American Naval Secretary James Forrestal, where he said something like that Ambassador Kennedy said that Roosevelt was trying to put iron up Chamberlain's backside. So Roosevelt was pushing the British to be more anti-German, although some question how much influence he had on the British. Now, Hitler did have demands on Poland, but he wanted, remember I was talking before about this, Danzig was a German city, was under the League of Nations High Commissioner. The Poles controlled its foreign relations. So he wanted the Poles to agree to return of Danzig to Germany and also have a motor road across the Polish corridor to East Prussia. Remember, the Treaty of Versailles, they've taken certain German territory away from Germany and put it into Poland. This is the Polish corridor. And as a result of that, part of Germany, East Prussia, was separated from the rest of Germany. So Hitler said, well, we want you to agree to have let us construct a motor road so we can get access to East Prussia. And Poland, from the time they got this guarantee in March to September 1939, refused to negotiate. They said, we're not going to accept these men. We don't want to talk to you about them. So Hitler invaded Poland on September 1st, and Britain and France declared war on Germany September 3rd. Now, it's ironic that it appears that although Hitler had these demands on Poland, he had hoped to come to terms with Poland, and he wanted to have good relations with England, like the British Empire, he was hoping for some kind of agreement with them. But one thing that's very clear about Hitler, if he made demands, he would try to make demands he thought that at least to him were reasonable. And if you didn't accept these demands, then he would really take action. He wouldn't back down. He was certainly somebody who would insist, if you don't accept this, then I'm going to invade. He did. So now, when Hitler did that, Roosevelt wanted to enter the war on the British side, but he had a problem, which was the great majority of people in the U.S. wanted to stay out of the war. And people certainly hoped that the Nazis would lose, that they didn't want to get involved. And Roosevelt was aware of this. I mean, in the 1940 election, in November 1940, he said in a famous speech, he said, "I have said this before, but I shall say it again and again and again. Your boys are not going to be sent into any foreign wars." This is a very famous speech. Of course, the way Roosevelt said, he had a very aristocratic accent, or some British accent. "I shall say it again and again and again." People quoted that later on when we did get involved in the war. Now, remember, under the Neutrality Act, arms and supplies had been sent to Britain and France on a cash and carry basis. So the Lend-Lease Act in March 1941 allowed material to be sent on the basis of loans, so the British and French didn't have to pay for this material. So this is one thing Roosevelt was very anxious to get passed, that they could give. So now the U.S. isn't involved in the war officially, but we're giving a lot of military aid to Britain and France. Then on June 22, 1941, Germany invaded Russia. And after this, Russia was then included in Lend-Lease aid. Now, at the time, it was very funny. The Communist Party in America, they had a whole lot of sympathizers, with Communist Party travelers. They had previously been opposed to the war because, remember, the Soviets had signed a non-aggression pact with Germany on August 23, 1939, the Molotov-Ribbentrop pact. But now, as soon as the Germans invaded Russia and the Communists and all their supporters, they, the U.S. has to get into the war right away. They really changed overnight. They said, well, now we've got the America has to get into the war to help Russia. So we now then have the problem for Roosevelt. He faced a public that for the most part didn't want to get into the war, but he wants to get into the war. He said, well, I think America needs to get into the war to help the British, French, and Russians. So what am I going to do? Now, Charles Tansel and other revisionist historians have suggested that Roosevelt tried to solve this problem by provoking the Japanese to attack us. And because of the Axis Pact, which had been signed, I think, in 1939 between Japan, Germany, and Italy, this would enable Roosevelt to bring America into the war in Europe, his main concern, because Germany was Japan's ally, so if Japan attacked the U.S., then Germany would then declare war on us, and Roosevelt would be able to get into the war in Europe, even though he avoided the problem that people didn't want to get involved in the war. He said, well, now we have to get in the war because the Japanese have attacked us and the Germans have declared war on us. Now, how did Roosevelt provoke the Japanese? Well, what he did was he almost completely shut off oil exports to them in July 1941. This would be fatal to the Japanese economy because the U.S. supplied about 90% of Japan oil. So they'd have to then go into the Dutch East Indies. If they wanted oil, it would be very difficult for them because really cost complete collapse of their economy. Now, an objection to this revisionist view is that, maybe the reason Roosevelt embargoed the oil was he wanted to stop Japanese aggression against China. So why we need this extra hypothesis of this backdoor to war? Maybe he just said, well, he's very concerned that China's being attacked by the Japanese. Remember, they'd gone in Manchukuo, and in 1937 they renewed their attack on China. So why we need this backdoor explanation? Well, in response to this, the oil embargo was issued with no warning to Japan. We didn't say, look, the Japanese, look, if you don't stop your aggression, we're going to embargo oil. It issued with no warning, and Japan was not told that stopping the aggression would result in ending the embargo. Then, on November 26, 1941, the U.S. issued an ultimatum demanding the Japanese withdraw completely from China and French Indochina. And Roosevelt and the Secretary of State, Cordell de la Hull, rejected any more conciliatory measures. It wouldn't be likely that the Japanese would agree to withdraw completely, but they have been giving some signs, well, maybe if you end the embargo, maybe we can have some sort of partial withdrawal. But Roosevelt wasn't having any of this. He, this, I think, supports this back to the war hypothesis. Look, the Japanese, you must get out right away. And Cordell Hull said November 27 to Henry Stimson, who was the Secretary of War, remember him, the Secretary of State, under Wilson, he said, it is now in the hands of you and Knox. Knox is referring to Frank Knox, who was the Secretary of the Navy, the Army and the Navy. So he's saying, Stimson was in charge of the Army and Knox in charge of the Navy. So he's saying, it's now in the hands of Army and Navy. So he's pretty clear there's going to be war because of his ultimatum. And even further, if we look at Stimson's diary for November 25th, it seems to indicate the U.S. hoped to provoke a Japanese attack because Stimson says, a famous passage, the question was how we should maneuver them, meaning the Japanese, into the position of firing the first shot without allowing too much danger to ourselves. And for example, I think it was a difficult proposition. Now, Tanto, Charles Count Tanto, Harry Barnes, John T. Flynn, and Charles Beard, among others, think that Roosevelt deliberately withheld information from the Army and Navy in Hawaii. They think not only did Roosevelt trying to provoke Japanese attack, they think, well, he had reason to think they're going to attack Hawaii, and he withheld information from them. This is a very controversial view, but these historians have accepted it. And one point in its favor, this is a point that Charles Beard stressed, was that the Admiral James O. Richardson, who had been Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet, had protested locating the fleet at Pearl Harbor. He said, if you do this, we're just opening us up, the fleet up to Japanese attack. We shouldn't have it at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. So Roosevelt responded by removing him as Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet in February 1941. I'm not going to go into the details of this controversy, but it does appear the U.S. knew that the Japanese attack was imminent from the messages that they decoded, but whether it's controversial, whether they deliberately intended the attack on Pearl Harbor. So I think I'll end the lecture at this point. I've gone a few minutes over, so we'll now have questions and objections. Now, I see it, there were some questions before I go to the Q&A. I see someone has asked, Rudy asked, about the incidents where the Germans heard on radio, Polish soldiers had attacked German radio stations. They were really German soldiers. I mean, they were really Polish prisoners dressed up as Polish soldiers. The Germans kind of faked this into. Well, I think that did take place, but it shouldn't be exaggerated. Some people tend to exaggerate the importance of that Leibniz incident. The Germans were pretty clear, if you look at Hitler's speech, the Reichstag, that he mentioned this and said there were border incursions. But what he really stresses is that the Poles were negotiating on the terms he wanted. Now, I see Malcolm asked, if Chamberlain made this piece, why was he viewed as soft on Germany? It was passive. Well, I don't think he was viewed as passive, but he was viewed as soft on Germany principally because of the Munich Agreement. Okay, so now I think I'm going to go. Let's see, did I miss anything else? Is it correct the British paid back the war debts until a few years ago? I think, yes, I think they were paying. I don't think they ever paid them back fully, but they were making payments still fairly recently. I think I'll go with the Q&A. I see that there are a few more things in the chat box. I think I'll go with the Q&A now. We have a lot of points. Where did the Allied forces think that Germany was going to get the money? Did they not see hyperinflation in the future if Germany kept printing? Well, I think it's hard to say. I think they thought the German economy would be capable of coming up with the goods. And Keynes said, well, look, you're having barriers to trade with Germany. But the Allies, I don't think, anticipated hyperinflation. They just thought that the Germans could pay or at least could pay something. Now, Forrest says, Lusitania, I read that it spent a month in New York being outfitted as an armament ship. Germany tried to put ads warning not to board it, but only Detroit Free Press would run the ad. True or false? Well, I think other papers ran ads also. Churchill refused escort. I think that's right. Malcolm says, Ben, besides, already indicated the rising price of commodities in Europe to expand the cost of our imports from these countries and giving them larger buying power here. How does that give them larger buying power here? Well, I'm not sure where that quotation is coming from, but I guess the idea, I'd have to check that, but I guess the idea would be if we're paying higher prices for imports, we're not really reducing that much how much we import. They've got more money to spend, so that's why they've got larger buying power. And I don't know where that quotation. Now Malcolm says, would you say that even a build-up to war, the country supplying the warring nations lose because of inflation, greater disparity of wealth, causing the contraction happens after the expansion? That's what I gathered from reading. Yeah, I think that's a very good point, Rick, that these artificial booms don't really work. They just cause trouble later. So military spending isn't, or spending on any government spending isn't the cure for depressed conditions. Now, Matt said, is it generally expected that Hitler intended to take over the world, or he just wanted to restore pre-World War I Germany? Well, I think for the dominant view would be something like Hitler sort of had ambitions to become a very dominant power. I think there are probably people who say, most people say, he wasn't trying to take over the world. He did want to agree with the British Empire after all. But people differ on what they think the extent of Hitler's ambitions were. The revisionist historians tend to think that Hitler's ambitions were more limited. Now, Peter says, how did FDR stop oil imports? Oil companies or private company able to trade with whoever they like? Well, because they require licenses to ship the oil that be made by the government. I think there's a legislation allowing the government to restrict oil imports. The reason I said they almost completely cut off, but they didn't say the Japanese can't get anything, but they made the licensing provision so cumbersome that in effect they didn't get anything. So, Peter, it isn't true that if it's a private company they can trade whatever they like. It's subject to government legislation. What was the title of Charles Beard's book you mentioned earlier? There are two. One is called American foreign policy in the making, 1932 and 1940, and the other one is President Roosevelt and the coming of the war, 1941. As in the last one, in the Beard ends the book, he mentions a statement that quotes from James Madison, prophecy that he made in 1831, saying that 100 years later, 1931, would be a time of big crisis for our country, and it turned out that was the case. And I think he ends the book and says, and we're facing this crisis with no divinity hedging our republic against Caesar. It's a very memorable phrase. Justin, could you go over the concept of outlaw nations again? Well, this, remember, is in Roosevelt's speech October 5th, 1937, the famous Chicago Bridge speech. And the notion is that they're, just to say, in, we think of within a country, most people are following the law, but there are certain criminals who aren't. The outlaw nations say, well, there are some criminals, nations, or outlaws who are really the bad guys, so the other nations have got to do something. They've got to quarantine them, just like the people have a dangerous illness. Sidney, they feel that World War II was justified because of the Holocaust. Was it a time of cause of the war? No, because at that time, the U.S. wasn't very sympathetic at all to admitting Jewish refugees. I think one of the high officials in the State Department, Breckinridge Long, his very good friend of Roosevelt, didn't want to have the refugees come in at all. He thought they were dangerous. So, you see, Hitler, in his speech to the Reichstag in January 1939, had said, if there's a new war in Europe, which he said would be Jewish international bankers are bringing on, the result will not be the elimination of the Jewish race in Europe. So it's very threatening. But so he's saying, well, if there's a war started, it's going to be very bad for the Jews. But there weren't very much effort by the Allies to help the Jews or sort of stop getting into a war because of Hitler's threat. So I don't think this was really a cause of the war. I mean, people really were that concerned about it at the time. And Malcolm said, did the original story talk about when General Billy Mitchell was a lieutenant or captain of Asia, why the author of full report Japan would attack while it was foil, would do so at 8 a.m. on a Sunday? Well, that's an interesting point. I don't think most of the revisions don't mention that. That's a very interesting point. I mean, there had been naval exercise in 1932 that showed that the Pearl Harbor would be subject to a surprise attack. But that is a very interesting point. Now, Peter says, why did Hitler invade Russia? Didn't they have a non-aggression plan? Well, here's a very interesting issue. You see, it appears that the Russians, although they had this non-aggression pact, they were violating the pact in certain ways. Tried to overthrow the pro-German government in Yugoslavia that led to a German takeover of that country, and then they made demands on Romania for Bessarabia. And there had been a meeting in November 1940 where the German foreign minister, Molotov, had been talking to Hitler and von Ribbentrop in Berlin, and they couldn't come to an agreement. So there's some evidence also that Russians had very advanced troop deployment. So Hitler thought, well, he's going to get in and attack them first. I mean, really, of course, although he had this pact with Russia, he was always very strongly anti-communist, so he thought this would be a good time to invade. I mean, it's very much disputed whether the Russians were planning anything. They were certainly surprised by Hitler attacked them. Now, Brian says, did British propaganda play any role for U.S. entry into World War II like it did in World War I? Well, certainly it did. I mean, there's I think I reviewed a book on that years ago. I titled it, not coming to mind, but the British had very extensive propaganda under Sir William Stevenson and others. They had very close ties to Hollywood. They were supporting movies that were attacking the Germans. And you can see, I think there's the Sherlock Holmes movie where they're talking about the danger of German, the British actors, British actor Leslie Howard was in movies of that kind. So there are all sorts of British propaganda. Now, Rudy says, why didn't Hitler just continue the politics of Bismarck? Well, that's an interesting suggestion. I think he had rather more, and certainly Bismarck never planned German expansion to the east the way Bismarck did. But, so I think he was more of a much more active and aggressive policy than Bismarck did. It's an interesting suggestion. I'll tell you, while we're waiting for the next question, I'll tell you a rather funny story, at least I think it's funny. In June 1979, I heard a lecture by the revisionist historian James J. Martin. Some of you may have read him. He was speaking at a conference at the Cato Institute, and he made the statement that some people wouldn't accept the evidence that Roosevelt had been aware that the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor, even if they found a signed confession saying that Roosevelt not only was aware of the attack, but within the lead Japanese plane dropping bombs. So then that really made me laugh. And then later on, I was invited to this libertarian group supper club to give a talk on World War II origins. They were getting ready to tape recording, and this statement by Martin just came into my mind. I couldn't stop laughing, and they had to stop the tape before I regain my composure because I thought it was so funny. But it was kind of a bit embarrassing for me. Rudy says, it's true that Stalin allowed the German Army and Air Force training Russians early 30s. Oh yeah, this had been going on through the 1920s. So this is the Apollo Pact in the 1920s, where the German Army had been training in Russia as a way of getting out of the disarmament provision treaty of Versailles. So that had been going on for a long time. Now, Leslie, did you know Martin very well? No, I just met him that one time at the Cato Conference. I was introduced to him, I spoke to him. He was a very nice man, kind of a very crusty person, very nice. Joel said, will we discuss the land division that occurred after World War II during next week's lecture, Berlin, Israel? Well, that could probably come in. You know, I'll have to see what, like I say, when I'm getting together next week's lecture. You know, I'm very dilatory in getting these lectures together. I don't know what I'm going to say till I write the lecture, so that would certainly be an important topic, but you know, I can't really say what I'm going to say next week. But we'll find out. I hope I'll find out when I talk, I guess. Justin, there's a lot of popular culture giving you World War II presents Hitler as the main propagator of the war. Do you think it's a flawed analysis? Well, I mean, he was certainly willing to go into Poland, even if the other countries were trying to stop him. But I don't think he didn't want a war with France and Britain. He wanted to get along with the British Empire. So I think the British, at that time, especially Andrew Lord Halifax, were determined to stop him. So I think the question raised would depend on whether you say, well, should we say that because Hitler insists on invading Poland, does that make him the main cause of the war? So how you answered that would really determine whether you assign principal responsibility to Hitler for the outset of the war. Peter says, how was the League of Nations rejected by the U.S.? This is Wilson's shining moment for after the Senate rejected. Yes. Yes, they did. Basically, what happened was there were sort of various groups in the Senate, various Republicans, that, well, we want to have various amendments to the treaty to guarantee American sovereignty. We don't want to get it involved in wars unless there's a declaration of war by Congress. And Wilson didn't want to agree to these changes. And there was another group called the Irreconcilables that included William Borah of Idaho said, we don't want to sign the treaty at all. So it's kind of a division, three factions in the Senate. People favored the treaty the way Wilson did. People who favored the people who opposed the treaty, said those people who would agree to the treaty, but with certain modifications, and they weren't able to get the treaty passed. And Rudy says, well, the coincidence the parachutes dropped a bridge too far with Polish. I'm not understanding that question. Could you possibly rephrase that? I don't get that. The Russians had a problem with the Polish. I'm not sure. Of course, the Russians took over eastern Poland. They invaded September 17, 1939, following the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. They thought the Germans are going too far, so they're going to take over part of Poland themselves. The thing you talked about, the Katyn Forest massacre. Yes, the Russians killed a large number of Polish officers, I think several thousand, they were just all shot in the head. Yes, that's a famous incident. And then they tried to blame the Germans discovered the bodies, and then it caused a lot of trouble because the Polish government exile wanted an investigation of what happened. And then the Russians broke off diplomatic relations with them. So that's a very famous incident, the Katyn Forest massacre, you're quite right. I think we have maybe one more question. We're awesome. And my earlier question about Hitler, I mean, do you think that some other individual left the Nazi Party where they've started the war? That's hard to say. My guess is probably not, I think. Hitler had, I mean, I don't think Hitler had a certain dynamism, but I don't think any of the other Nazi leaders really had. They wouldn't have been able to do too much. I don't think the Nazis would have gotten anywhere without Hitler, really. So it's unfortunate he was around. But I guess we're about out of time now. So thank you, everybody, for coming. I hope we'll see you all next week. We're talking about the Cold War, Korean War. So we'll try to get something together for that. So thanks. Thank you for coming to my lecture. Hope to see you all next week. Thank you.